Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. A U.S. federal judge in Washington state has temporarily blocked nationwide ban imposed last week on travelers and immigrants from seven predominantly Muslim nations. U.S. District Judge James Robart in Seattle ruled Friday that the states of Washington and Minnesota have legal standing to challenge President Donald Trump's executive order.
The court concludes that entry of the above-described TRO is necessary, and the state's motion is hereby granted.
The U.S. Customs and Border Protection say they will comply with the order. The White House later Friday issued a statement saying the Justice Department at the earliest possible time would follow an emergency stay of this outrageous order. Shortly after, the White House issued a second statement without the word outrageous. The statement also defended President Trump's executive order as lawful and appropriate. The United Nations is imposing new sanctions on 13 individuals and 12 entities linked to Iran's ballistic missile program and its proxies across the Middle East in light of this week's missile test by Iran. The new sanctions are a culmination of the Trump administration's stance with Tehran following a presidential campaign in which then-candidate Trump said he was willing to do away with the nuclear deal. Former President Barack Obama and other world leaders negotiated. U.S. Defense Chief Jim Mattis says that the United States recognizes Japan's administration of the Senkaku Islands, a comment quickly criticized by China. Mattis has been in Tokyo meeting with the prime minister. He told reporters that it is important to let Japan know of the U.S. commitment to their long-standing relationship. Earlier in South Korea, he said that any nuclear attack by the North on any U.S. or allies will be met with a response. The head of the United Nations Refugee Agency says a proposed initiative to create safe zones in Syria for refugees would not work in the country. Filippo Grandi is just back from Syria.
This is a gesture which I think is important in the international refugee protection system. If we weaken that program, as has been done in the United States, it's a very dangerous weakening of the international solidarity for refugees.
A U.S. military official says an American Navy destroyer is patrolling off the coast of Yemen to protect international waterways from Houthi militia aligned with Iran. This comes after a Houthi suicide attack on a Saudi frigate in the Red Sea Monday killed two crew members. The United Nations has removed the notorious Afghan warlord. The move comes months after the president's government sealed a peace deal with the HIG, an insurgent faction. The truce is required to cease fighting against the Afghan government in return for the removal from the UN blacklist, along with other leaders of the faction. U.S. federal officials say more than 9.2 million people signed up for health insurance through the Affordable Care Act during open enrollment from November to January. That is despite Republican efforts to repeal the program, then replace it with an alternative health care plan. The total number of enrollees was down 500,000 from the open enrollment period last year. And the turmoil over the future of the program, widely known as Obamacare, the decline was smaller than predicted. Of the 9.2 million enrollees this year, about 3 million were new clients, while the rest were continuing their coverage from last year. That's according to government figures. The open enrollment is seen as a test of the popularity of the federal health care program, which offers programs in 39 states. The remaining states run their own health care exchanges. It is World Cancer Day this Saturday, and hundreds of different activities have been planned around the world to mark the event. According to the World Health Organization, about 14 million people are diagnosed with cancer every year, and even with treatment, and kills more than 8 million people every year. But researchers in Maine are looking at a new way to fight the disease that does not have the side effects of chemotherapy. They say that they're treating cells with a class of molecules that pushes them into a spiral of self-destruction. They say that the new class of molecules just turns off the cancer's ability to control mutation. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
Everybody has invested so much in those discussions here in the country, and I'm hoping that the government is going to continue being serious about how we take all this process forward.
Talks between the Congolese government and the opposition Rassemblement are set to resume next week.
The current situation in the British Southern Cameroon is still the same. It is one in which there is total panic. It is one in which the population has been imbued under fear. It is one in which the people don't have anything to rely on.
English-speaking Cameroonians demand an independent investigation into the arrests and disappearances of activists and ordinary civilians.
It's been estimated that $1.6 trillion are lost due to cancer, which is, of course, an enormous amount. These are costs to the healthcare system.
And February 4 is World Cancer Day. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Opposition groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, under the umbrella group Rassemblement, are expecting talks with the government will begin next week, despite the death of the group's leader, Etienne Tshisekedi. Opposition supporters and civil society organizations expressed concern that Tshisekedi's demise could imperil the transition agreement recently signed with the government. For more, I reach Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu, leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or known as Our Congo in the local Lingala language.
I can only say that it is my hope that the talks will resume and be taken to a fruitful conclusion because, you know, the passing of our elder and leader, Tshisekedi, only happened a couple of days ago. And, you know, we haven't had time to really test the goodwill of the government. Everybody has invested so much in those discussions here in the country. And I'm hoping that the government is going to continue being serious about how we take all this process forward and we do compute it.
How are opposition members or leaders like yourself dealing with the death of Etienne Tshisekedi? And do you think his death could affect the anticipated negotiations next week?
Well, the opposition, of course, is taking this very seriously. And as you know, Tshisekedi's sort of aura goes beyond the opposition. This is somebody who fought to get us to some kind of democratic level in this country, and I think he's widely recognized as an important political leader in the country. So his acceptance goes beyond the opposition. That said, as the opposition, we are taking very seriously the talks. In our view, completing the discussions would help sort of consolidate President Tshisekedi's political, you know, as we say here, heritage in this country, his political legacy. We are going to be working hard to make sure that we complete the discussions successfully so that, you know, as I said, we could consolidate his political legacy of bringing democracy to this country.
Do you have a formal structure as the Rassemblement? Now that the leader is dead, do you have somebody who will rally all of you guys together in these negotiations with the government?
Well, as you know, President Tshisekedi was the head of the Wise Men's Committee in our Rassemblement, and you know, it's going to be falling upon us now to decide who will eventually lead the group at that particular level going forward. But at the same time, we've been working together very closely since his passing, making sure that there is good coordination between the different platforms that are in the Rassemblement. As you know, we have the Dynamique L'Opposition in there, of which I'm a member, but also President Tshisekedi's UDPS party. You have the G7, of which we have some good friends that are there as well. So I think what we're trying to do for the time being is to make sure that there's good coordination between the different platforms of the Rassemblement until such time as somebody would eventually emerge to that the position of leadership in our group, eventually replacing that capacity the late President Tshisekedi.
What assurances will the Rassemblement give the people of Congo? Because they are expressing concern that the death of Tshisekedi, as well as recent reports that the government has gone to the UN to say that the resurgence of the M23 rebel group could undermine the agreement they signed with the opposition. Some are expressing concern in Congo that this could help President Kabila not to keep the agreement signed with the opposition. What assurances can you give the people of Congo?
First of all, we're going to be working hard as the opposition to make sure that this agreement is respected. Secondly, I think we've told the people of this country that they've got to remain vigilant, to continue being committed to monitoring developments as we go forward. One of the most important guarantees that we can have to ensure that the agreement is respected is the level of commitment by the people of this country. And I think we are saying that very clearly. The agreement is very clear. We've got to make sure that we have this election as soon as possible in 2017. And we're going to be working hard as part of the new government that is eventually going to be set up so that we are able to achieve this particular objective. The other guarantee is the commitment of the international community. As you know, we've been working very closely with all of our major partners in the international community, the UN, the United States of America, France, Belgium, Great Britain, Canada, Sweden, the European Union. Everybody is involved and just trying to do their bit so that we have about the possibility of ensuring a very successful implementation of this agreement.
Freddy Mbuyamu Matungulu is leader of the opposition Congo Nabiso Party, or Our Congo, in the local Lingala language. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. English-speaking Cameroonians are demanding an independent investigation into the ongoing arrests and disappearances of activists and ordinary civilians, this after expressing concern that the government is undermining their freedom of expression. It comes as internet connections appear to have been cut in the major towns of the English-speaking regions for the last 3 weeks. The action also followed an intensified months-long strike by local lawyers and teachers. For more, I reached Ebenezer Mbongo Akwanga, leader of the Southern Cameroon's Youth League.
The current situation in the British Southern Cameroon is still the same. It is one in which there is total panic. It is one in which the population has been imbued under fear. It is one in which the people don't have anything to rely on. There is even fear that the regime is going to take away electricity and pipe-borne water. The annexationist is trying to get people from the Bakuri land and a couple of others from the southwest, where I hear from, to issue communiques, not knowing that these things no longer work.
Why isn't the group or members of the group that are agitating for their rights to be respected and for them to be heard not forming an alliance to negotiate with the government in Yaoundé to address some of these concerns that you've raised?
Negotiate? That is a very, very good word. Who do you negotiate with? Now, the African Human Rights Commission in Banjul decided in one of their rulings in the case Kevin Gwangumne versus Cameroon, which was brought up by the Southern Cameroon's People's Organization, SCAPO, alongside members of the Southern Cameroon's National Council, that the people of the Southern Cameroons are, in quote, a nation that is their people. And they asked the government of Mr. Paul Biya to enter into negotiation with those who are clamoring, and rightfully, for their full and total freedom. Mr. Biya ignored that decision and is acting as if nothing has ever happened. By the way, La République du Cameroun feel they have overwhelming force and they have no right to negotiate with us. And they have just proven that to the rest of the world. Rather than find a solution rather than listen to the people's call.
People I've spoken with in the English-speaking Cameroon areas are expressing concern that it appears there's not a united front, there's not a single group that is spearheading and advocating on their behalf, and that they fear could be exploited by the administration in Yaoundé to address some of these concerns that you've enumerated.
When people talk about united front, what type of front do they mean? Are they talking a united front on a particular purpose? The question we should ask ourselves, are all of these groups having a single purpose, which is the total and unconditional independence or freedom or whatever word people want to call it for the people of the former British Southern Cameroons? Or is it that the people just want one person to stand there and say, I am the head of this? Listen, this is going to happen. It will not happen that people will sit on the table and say they come together, because there are so many different ideas. There are people who think that they can follow the legal means. Others think they can keep on talking for another 55 years and then they will have independence or freedom. It's not going to work. When one group will emerge or one individual, it is when we will change the status quo on the ground. It is when our people will have the possibility, the minimal possibility, to say, no, we will not accept suicide. We have the right under international law to defend ourselves. That is when that leadership, that single group will emerge.
What's the end game for the people of English-speaking Cameroon? Because people of the English-speaking areas complain of oppression, complain of being looked down on. What are the next steps forward?
The answer is simple. We are moving to the phase where we will have to start defending ourselves, because we are dealing with a very brutal annexationist who is prepared to wipe our entire land. And we are no longer going to see it. We are no longer just going to keep marching on the streets, carrying placards, going to different courts, hoping that someday God will come from heaven to save us. It is not going to happen. It is unfortunate that the only time that the conscience of the world community will be pricked, it is when we will have the capacity to stand as a people and let the rest of the world know, and La République du Cameroun, that has annexed us, know that they will not decapitate us. Unfortunately, during this period, it is one side that is armed. And that side that is armed is that side that has given a deaf ear to a permanent positive peace for our people. So it's time for us to start fighting back. I am asking our people to give us the minimal, I'm not talking of maximum, the minimal possibility, the minimal means for our men and women to start defending their homeland and defending their own survival. That is the next stage. It is a state that has been imposed upon us. It is what has been imposed upon us by a docile world community. So we are now ready for that next phase.
Ebenezer Mbongo Akwanga is the leader of the Southern Cameroons Youth League and member of the Ambazonian Governing Council. He spoke with me from Houston, Texas. Witch doctors in Swaziland have accused members of parliament of double standards by passing a law restricting their activities while at the same time using their services. The Witch Doctors Trade Union, known as the Tinyanga Association, petitioned the Ministry of Health and the Public Prosecution's Office to have the Witchcraft Act amended. This after an officer at the Director of Public Prosecution told the witch doctors to stop murdering people to obtain body parts for their spells. For more, I read Kenneth Dlamini, news editor at the Swazi Observer, an independent news organization in Swaziland's capital, Mbabane.
Yes, Peter, that is true. Actually, it happened last week. The witch doctors had a meeting in one of the city's main towns where they made it clear that they were tired of the double standards by most of the parliamentarians who are on the other side. They want their services banned, but on the other hand, they are the very people who sneak at night. And
I understand the Tinyanga Association or the trade unions of the witches or traditional healers are objecting to Section 2 of the Witchcraft Amended Act. They have petitioned the Ministry of Health and Public Prosecution's office to have the Witchcraft Act amended because the act basically makes their practice illegal. What specifically do they want?
Yes, that's what they feel this particular edge is restricting their services, and thus they want it amended. Because as they are saying, this is practically double standards by the parliamentarians, and because they are the lawmakers, yet they are the people who want to restrict their act in Swaziland.
The act, as I understand, is that any person who is found wearing any charm dress, which according to Swazi custom indicates the wearer as a diviner, witch doctor or witch, shall be guilty of an offence and liable on conviction of a fine of 200 emelengani, which is approximately $14 or an imprisonment not exceeding 5 months. Some people say that this is too harsh. What are Swazi saying about this?
Yes, that is why they feel it's, the law is too harsh, and they feel that should be amended because they practically feel their services should be open to everyone. Like, if you decide to consult their medical practitioners, then you should have a choice whether you decide to consult which doctor, even if it is during the day or at night. So their services shouldn't be restricted to people who only consult them at night when it suits them.
Do Swazis embrace this kind of spirituality?
And naturally, Swazis are people who have this inborn thing about having to consult with traditional healers. It is in depth in them that they really have to consult with traditional healers.
Well, some Swazis I spoke with are saying that since Swazis in general embrace this traditional spirituality, the laws against them, they said, is too harsh and it's hypocritical. What have you heard about this?
Yes, I think that most people are feeling they are quite sympathetic to the traditional healers because, as I say to you, Peter, it is common in Swaziland to consult with them. So, really, there's a general feeling that they feel this law is just too harsh because it is something that is born in them, that they know they have to. It's either choose to go. Most of the time, it's the people in the rural areas that consult mainly with the traditional healers. And if you are now you are saying you are restricting their services, what are you saying? Because that's the large population of the country. Yet we know even in the urban areas or even the politicians, those are the ones that consult them at night.
Do you think their petition to the Ministry of Health as well as the Public Prosecution's Office would have the act amended by parliamentarians, especially when they have come out to criticize these lawmakers for being hypocrites?
I wouldn't be sure right now, Peter. Seriously, I think right now what the traditional healers are doing, they are lobbying against that kind of law that is restricting them. But I am sure they must be doing their homework well in terms of conversing for support to amend this law.
Kenneth Dlamini is the news editor at the Swazi Observer. He spoke with me from Imbabani. There are growing calls for the withdrawal of the Kenyan Defense Forces, or KDF, from Somalia. This following recurrent attacks in northern Kenya by the terrorist group Al-Shabaab. The Democratic Party has urged President Uhuru Kenyatta to recall the soldiers and instead deploy them to conduct surveillance in the country. David Ohito is the outgoing digital editor at the Standard Media Group and aspiring member of parliament. My colleague Douglas Impuga reached him in Kisumu to find out where KDF is likely to remain in Somalia.
The reaction has not been very patriotic in the latest incident. Following the Kulbio and El Adi attacks, which happened almost the same time, 1 year apart. So there is a challenge, first of all, from lack of morale within the ranks of soldiers and also the limited support they claim to be getting from their generals and the government in general. And for the families that have lost their gallant sons and daughters, of course, there's continuous mourning, and there's not really the argument that would let the Kenyan forces stay in Somalia. And secondly, there's also the cry that they're better off lined up along the border than being inside and being exposed to attacks from the militia.
The Democratic Party has called on the these KDF forces to be withdrawn from Somalia and instead, as you said, be deployed instead to conduct surveillance in the country. Is this view shared by many people in Kenya?
Not really, but there's been a push that we need to reorganize our forces. We need to have, you know, the operation brought to naught, you know. When they left Kenya to cross into the border, people thought it would be a 1-2 year operation, but it's staying longer. Of course, there's the angle that there are big people doing business in Somalia and are looking at personal interests at the expense of the interests of soldiers.
How serious is the government of Kenya taking the call to review or reconsider their mission in Somalia?
I don't think that has been within the agenda of the current government, because they've said they needed their troops there. They've never tabled reports which investigated the two serious attacks, El Adi and Kulbio. And that leaves members of the public in great doubt of what really transpired. People are looking for the truth, but it's very hard to come by the truth.
KDF presence in Somalia don't seem to have deterred attacks on Kenya by Al-Shabaab. How does the government explain that?
Well, it's not only Kenyan troops who have been attacked. They have been attacked on Burundian forces and I think other countries. And we've also had the Ugandan tragedy of the helicopters that were involved in an accident. So the operation has been receiving mixed feelings and reports. Over the attack on Kenyan ranks, of course, there are concerns that why should Kenya be attacked again and again, and there seems to be no action. Do we really have the right equipment? Do we really have the right deployment? Are we using latest technologies and even intelligence to defend our positions and to launch attacks on the militia? There have been very many concerns raised about that.
David Ohito is the outgoing digital editor at the Standard Media Group. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Kisumu. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports the lives of millions of more than 8 million people who die every year from cancer could be saved if their disease was diagnosed early. For VOA, Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva, where WHO has launched new cancer guidelines in advance of World Cancer Day on February 4.
Cancer has reached epidemic proportions globally. Once considered a disease of people in rich countries, the World Health Organization says that no longer is the case. It says two-thirds of all cancer deaths now occur in low- and middle-income countries. Health officials say cancer deaths in the poorer countries are projected to rise from the current 8.2 million yearly to more than 9 million by 2030. If action is not taken to better diagnose, detect, and treat the disease at an early stage. Etienne Krug is director of WHO's Department for the Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Disability, Violence, and Injury Prevention. Besides the cost in lives lost, he says there is a huge financial cost associated with cancer.
It's been estimated that $1.6 trillion are lost due to cancer, which is, of course, an enormous amount. These are costs to the healthcare system. Treating cancer is very expensive, but also the lost productivity, etc.
Krug says cancer for a long time was considered a death sentence. He says that is changing. He says cancer can be prevented by tackling risk factors such as smoking, unhealthy diets, reducing air pollution, and cutting down on alcohol intake. He says a lot also can be done to help people who already are diagnosed with cancer.
It does not have to be a death sentence. There's a lot we can do in terms of early diagnosis and screening, in terms of improving treatment, surgery, chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and when needed, palliative care.
For this year's World Cancer Day, WHO is focusing on the importance of early diagnosis. It says patients who are diagnosed early and receive prompt treatment will have a better chance of surviving cancer. This is especially true for people who have breast, cervical, and colorectal cancers. WHO adds cancer, which is diagnosed and detected at an early stage, also will be less expensive to treat and cure. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Yeah, no, no, no. nze sichalosi, sichalosi, nze sichalosi ndi boss, sichalosi. Dance, dance. Yefaba vubu kembumulo, yefaba vubu kembumulo. Akalero kansonga, kakubye ndi mumundu ya chigoma. Sagala nyombo, kubange ino sawa ya nungo. Bagambye sagala nyombo, ino sawa ya chikiri. Mwama sembera, mulamu basova. Jangu chetare, yansiri hakulika. Nekanzine, nenzina mumama, mulamu wajisera. Ato muziki zuri sana, nekanzine. Nenzina mumama, wajisera. Sana. Nze sichalosi, sichalosi, nze sichalosi ndi boss, sichalosi. Dance, dance, abange, unobulamu bumbi, zengubame, kalimundeke nange. Kwenzi jukira muche mfuti, endoza tukubana, acholeka otada, nebakendi kakanga. Itali musana, oh mama, oh la la, yeah. Oh agariba, oh agariba,
achi toba kona chungamba, jango muziki tugusambe, bambe toba kona chungamba, jangwe nutwe changi,
aye le 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 le, aye le 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 le,
le kanzine,
nenzina mumama, unamu wajisera, ato muziki zuri sana,
le kanzine.
Zina yelelele yelelelo yelelele yelelelo
anko
nze tumala atonewa nze katamala mama tane sipata
le kanzine.
Bawa.
is life. I cannot kill myself, but lady tonight. Are you sure you can take this love? DJ jam this song, all my people sing along. We live for the party, for nobody. We live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy, we live for the party. Oh, no send no. I say we live for the party. Oh Lord have mercy.
You be miracle, CC.
I defeat,
and I be your miracle, Papa. You're a miracle girl. Celle Papa, honey, me. I've been to think about you. For real, wouldn't know me today. I know we live without you tomorrow, today. You are my miracle, baby. Oh, you don't say after day, yeah. Papa, don't show me the way. If people they ask me, me, I go say, hey, who, why you my? Every time I think about the things you do,
honey, see, see,
yeah. Forever and ever, I'm me and you.
We go out of Panama,
God. God says we are destined to be together.
While my waters on to my God.
In a woman, my God.
Baby,
you be miracle, CC.
I defeat,
and I be your miracle, Papa.
Baby,
you be my miracle, CC.
I defeat,
and that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaites, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, it is from a small seed that the giant Iroko tree has its beginning. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
Certain aspects of the United States government are unique, none more so than the law of the land, the United States Constitution. Drafted in 1787 and ratified in 1789, it is the oldest such written document in continual use, and one that has influenced legal thinking and other constitutions around the globe. The Constitution's preamble, or introduction, begins with the words, "We the people," indicating that although the document was written to establish a national government, the government itself was set up to serve the people, and derives its power from them. The body of the document sets out the balance and separation of power among the three branches of government: the legislative, or lawmaking branch, that is the U.S. Congress, the executive branch, which is headed by the president, and the judiciary, which interprets the law at every level and settles legal disputes regarding the meaning and application of the law. Having just won a war to rid themselves of an authoritarian government, the framers of the Constitution were above all careful to create a national government that would not, could not, wield absolute power, but at the same time could not be superseded by individual states. So the Constitution defines the state's relationship to the federal government, as well as the rights and responsibilities of state governments. And, to ensure the document is flexible enough to stand the test of time, the framers made provisions that allowed for it to be changed or amended to reflect changes within society itself. Ironically, this helped the Constitution to overcome its first major hurdle: ratification by the 13 states that made up the United States of the time. That's because the populace, which had just freed itself from shackles imposed on it by one government, was loath to agree to empowering another such body. Many saw a strong central government as a threat to individual rights. So, to obtain ratification in the several vacillating states, 10 amendments, collectively named the Bill of Rights, were added. In the words of James Madison, who is considered to be the father of the Constitution, "The people are the only legitimate fountain of power, and it is from them that the constitutional charter, under which the several branches of government hold their power, is derived."
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.